I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Diabetes is a health crisis, not only in this country, but worldwide. Over 8% of people around the world have diabetes, and some 6.5% have what's called pre-diabetes. I'll ask my guests now about what that is and more. Joanna Burkhard and Barbara Allen have written a new cookbook, The Diabetes Prevention and Management Cookbook, your 10-step plan for nutrition and lifestyle. Barbara Allen joins me now. The book has some 150 recipes, as well as menu plans and exercise program, as well as information on blood on managing blood glucose, cholesterol, blood pressure, and more. It's an informative book, and the recipes therein look good. They look healthy, and if you're looking for something new to try, there's certainly lots in this book to taste. Barbara Allen is a registered dietitian and certified diabetes educator. She's an active volunteer and public speaker with the Canadian Diabetes Association, which also cooperated in the publication of this book. This book is published by Robert Rose. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Richmond, British Columbia, Barbara Allen. Ms. Allen, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So this book is really for everyone, isn't it? Because as the title says, it's just as much about prevention as it is management of diabetes.
Yeah, we'd like to look at it as a healthy eating book for anyone who wants to eat well. It's especially designed for those who have issues with their blood sugar, cholesterol, high blood pressure as well. But certainly anybody can appreciate the recipes and the health information.
Now, what accounts for this rise in diabetes? I mean, it is a crisis level, isn't it?
It really is. It's a multifactorial effect that we're seeing all around the globe. I mean, one of the main effects is that it's an aging population, particularly in Canada and the United States. In other countries around the world, there is a shift to the Western lifestyle and urbanization, high stress, change of dietary habits, much more processed foods. And those are probably the two of the most common factors causing this increase in diabetes.
Can it also be a genetic thing? So if there's a history of diabetes in one's family, can that result in one getting diabetes as well?
Yes, that is a very huge, huge factor, especially in type 2 diabetes. And I think it's really important that people appreciate that because, and sometimes in diabetes there is, particularly type 2, which is associated with a less than healthy lifestyle. It also is still very much a genetic condition, and I don't want people to be taking on guilt or shame when they get type 2. Even if they don't know who in their family has diabetes, it's in there. I think most of us could find someone who has diabetes, or it could be that it was in their family tree but just was not diagnosed.
What's the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes?
Type 1 is mostly found in younger people, children, and teens, but it can occur at any age. Whereas type 2 is found generally in older people, but as our lifestyle is not always conducive to health, we have young kids who are quite overweight, and they're getting type 2 at early as age 10, age 9.
Now, I know a couple of diabetics, and one takes insulin regularly, the other doesn't at all.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference there?
Well, people with type 1 diabetes have a condition whereby they must take insulin to live. Their pancreas has ceased to make a decent amount of insulin for them, so insulin by injection is a life-saving technique for them. People with type 2 diabetes can manage their diabetes for a time, often through diet, then potentially through medications. But finally, about 40% of people that have type 2 will require insulin to manage their diabetes.
And then I mentioned pre-diabetes in the introduction. What is that?
Pre-diabetes is an interim phase between normal and diabetes, and people with type 2 go through this. You know, we all start off with normal blood sugar, and then as we age or as our genetics come, are influenced as our diet, whatever, blood sugar can creep up gradually in a certain subset of the population. And that is what's called prediabetes. If one went to the lab and had their blood sugar measured, and it was between roughly 6 and 6.9, that's considered prediabetes. That's a fasting glucose, whereas diabetes is when you are 7.0 or higher.
And what accounts for the rise in that? Again, is that the Western diet and processed foods?
It totally is, and it also is a recognition of this condition as an entity. It really, I mean, I've been a dietitian for over 20 years, and prediabetes was really not talked about back when I started, and so I think it's just been appreciated now that you just don't get type 2 overnight, that you transition through this this time period, and it's also associated with what's called the metabolic syndrome, which is also a newish kind of condition, a cluster of high cholesterol, high blood pressure, and central obesity, that is weight that's situated in the front where you can see it on one's stomach.
Now, in the years that you've been a dietitian, have you seen sort of developments in with regards to managing it? I mean, in 20 years ago, we'd hear people, you know, losing limbs or going blind. I mean, that probably still happens, but does it happen as often?
Unfortunately, it happens too often.
I
can't give you the statistics, but we still do see it, and we still see it way more than we would ever want to.
I see.
I think when it comes to eyesight, there's been some good advances there. Earlier screening so that people don't have to lose their eyesight to the same degree as they may have. But diabetes still causes a lot of devastating complications, even in the 21st century.
And what are the symptoms that people ought to look for? I mean, obvious risk factors are if one's overweight or if their diet is poor.
Even being over 40 is a risk factor for type 2 diabetes, so it's pretty easy to have that. Symptoms of diabetes are the same for type 1 or type 2, but type 2s often don't experience the symptoms because in their case, the blood sugar creeps up so gradually over time. But if they were to experience symptoms, they would have the classic three polys, polyuria, which is peeing all the time, polydipsia, which is drinking all the time, and polyphagia, which is being very hungry. And this would be hungry and eating and yet not gaining weight, actually losing weight.
Huh. And so this book, I mean, it has all this information that we've just related and more. It also, you know, as I said in the introduction, everything looks tasty. I mean, the food that you have in here, it looks tasty and it's obviously healthy, right?
Yeah. Hats off to my co-author, Joanna Burkhard. This is her 8th cookbook, and she's the master of healthy and delicious food, particularly, too, in this book, though, she really wanted to tie into the low-sodium message, so that was a new element that she really brought to the table for this. She uses a lot of whole foods, a lot of herbs, fresh things, without using a gazillion ingredients, so I definitely give her all the credit for that. Half of the book.
Now, are those cooking habits that you're seeing a lot of that we ought to refrain from, say, using processed foods, a million ingredients, say?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the way that our grandparents ate, the more I learn about nutrition, it just keeps taking us back to this simple message. If it has 16 ingredients in it, it's probably, you know, if you can't pronounce what's in the food, it may not be as healthy as if it's stuff that you could grow in your garden, you can create without a lot of processing, that it didn't come out of a box. Those are going to be the most nutritious, most wholesome, and therefore most good for your blood sugar.
And I guess it goes into the stuff that we can't pronounce when we read a food label, say.
Yeah.
We need to pay attention to those sorts of things.
You know, it's all chemistry, and I don't mean to say that chemicals are bad necessarily, but, you know, anyone who's ever made bread knows that bread is flour and yeast and water and a bit of sugar, and that's about all you really need. When you go to your grocery store and you pick up a bread bag and it has 15 ingredients in it, so many of those, why are they there? Could we not have something simple and fresh and healthy?
You mentioned earlier about lower sodium, and we're hearing that a lot nowadays, but the interesting thing in your book is that sodium and salt aren't necessarily the same thing.
Yeah, sodium is a component of salt, but we also get sodium from other food additives, like sodium bicarbonate or sodium citrate or sodium, I can't even think of so many sodium compounds. Sodium nitrite might be one. Mind you, most of the sodium in our diet does come from salt.
I see.
So So we have made an effort to use less salt in our recipes. We definitely need some, and Joanna tested and retested until she could cut the salt down. But really, we're not able to get it out completely, and nor do we have to, as we do need some salt as sodium for our general well-being.
So in terms of how you and Joanna worked together, she's in Ontario, is that correct?
Yes, we met once, and then the rest of it we did by email and telephone.
Yeah, okay, so she would design the recipe, is that right?
Yeah, I provided to her what were my recommendations for calories, fat, saturated fat, cholesterol, sodium, carbohydrates, including fiber. And she put that all together into a meal plan, which we have 4 weeks worth of menu plans, so 3 meals for 4 weeks. And that provides 1,600 calories. Anybody who needs more calories, and I give an explanation of who that person might be, can add nutritious snacks. We have 100 and 200 calorie snack choices, ideas how to make those things, or things you could buy from the store to flesh out those options.
The other thing that's interesting about this book is that you do have this 28-day menu, your 3 meals a day, but you also have snacks, because I guess you know, that's important too, right?
Mm-hmm, it is. The menu plan is so important to this book because the number one question I get from clients is, just tell me what to eat. You know, we dietitians like to give all this information and the whys and the whos and the whatevers, but just tell me what to eat is what I'm being asked to do. So I hope this book will really tell you what to eat, how to make it. Here's the recipe. Here's what you put with it to make a balanced meal.
And eating healthy doesn't have to cost a lot. I mean, that's what worries a lot of people, right?
You know, it's debatable. Depending on where you live, eating healthy does cost more than eating unhealthfully, and that is a sad fact. I mean, around the province, we can find what's called food deserts, where there really is nowhere to shop except the convenience store. But if you have, you know, if you're living in an urban center and you've got a car or you've got good transit, you can get around to the various grocery stores, and you can comparison shop, and you can find produce very, very well priced at your little produce shops. You can buy your own flour and make your own bread. There's a lot of things you can do to save money. Legumes are almost, they're just about free, the dried beans, very low cost. You have to be a savvy shopper, but people do honestly tell me, they say, since I started eating more healthful, my grocery budget has gone down. I'm saving money. I'm not buying junk food.
And more fiber, that's something that you suggest too in this book, right?
Yeah, we're really big on fiber for so many reasons. One of our favorite reasons for fiber is it's filling. And we really want everyone to be full and content. So fiber fills you up. It's also super good for blood sugar, because as you're full, you tend to maybe eat a little bit less, and the less one eats, the less their blood sugar will go up. Fiber also can help lower one's blood cholesterol, and is also associated with having less heart disease. So it's got a lot of good functions. Besides the typical one of being good for regularity, there's a lot of other valuable reasons for having fiber.
Well, what's something that we can add to our diet that has fiber that doesn't taste, say, bad? Because, I mean, that's what worries a lot of people. But when we say the word fiber, you're thinking, well, it's that Metamucil stuff, you know?
Yeah. Some people really enjoy flax seeds, and they're grinding them up. They're putting them in their smoothies. They're putting them in their cereal or in their muffins. Oatmeal is a good source of fiber, and I think most people don't have an aversion to that. Mm-hmm. Buying steel-cut oats or large flake oats for a breakfast cereal is really nice. Whole grain breads, there's so many different ones in the market. There's no question that a person cannot find one that they're going to like. There's got to be oodles of them on the shelves. And you just have to kind of go with your taste buds. The highest fiber breads are going to be 5 or 6 grams of fiber per slice.
Huh.
And the lower ones, which are still healthy, are going to be around 3 to 4 grams per slice. So I invite people to read their food labels. First ingredient on the bread bag should be whole grain flour or whole grain wheat, whole grain something, and then per slice of fiber should be at least 3 grams.
And of course, vegetables, it's another good source for fiber, right?
It sure is. You know, we sadly don't eat many vegetables in this country, so I'd like to hope that people do. Kale's a big one right now. Everyone's putting kale in their smoothies or having sautéed kale or making kale chips. You just can crunch them up and heat them up in the oven, and, you know, people are going mad for them. So kind of at last, there's a famous vegetable.
Yeah. Rapini, that's also quite popular in restaurants. I've been seeing a lot of that, and you have a recipe in the book for that.
Yeah.
There was a story in the media recently about vitamins and whether we should have those as part of our regimens. Does one need, say, supplements? I mean, what's your experience with that?
Well, sadly, vitamins have not, you know, supplemental vitamins, say, taking a bottle of this or that, have not seemed to be really as effective as one might hope. And however, there are individual nutrients that we know we need more of. Women of childbearing age do need more folic acid. They will need more iron when they're pregnant. Older people will need more calcium than younger people. But the idea of just taking a multivitamin, there's really no good research that says this is going to benefit you. We really encourage, as we have for decades, eat food, eat quality food, because it also provides many, many more nutrients that can never be fit into a vitamin bottle.
Now, this book also gives the reader an idea of how to lose, say, 5 to 10% of one's weight. That's through the diet that's suggested in the book, as well as exercise and the sort. I mean, what sort of exercise are you recommending?
We would like to encourage a well-rounded form of exercise that includes some stretching, some meditation, then some cardio, and very importantly, some strength training. So strength training being as simple as sitting in front of the TV, using some soup cans to work the biceps, or even standing up and sitting down in a chair repeatedly. That works the front legs of the front muscles, the quadriceps, getting more, say, energetic. A person could use some Dynabands, which are resistance bands, sort of stretchy bands for working various muscles throughout the body. And others might feel more inclined to even go to the gym and use some free weights or some exercise machines. And it's building muscle which really combats the age-related decline that we all see in our muscle mass. And as we lose muscle, we do lose the potential to burn glucose as effectively as we should.
You can't tell by the weather in Vancouver today. I mean, it's raining hard. I'm assuming it's the same in Richmond.
Mm-hmm.
But summer supposedly is around the corner.
Yeah.
What sort of tips have you got in terms of what we should think about when we're at the buffet or at brunch or at a barbecue?
Oh, yeah. You know, we really feel that healthy eating can apply to any occasion, and that you never need to not go to a social occasion because you're trying to eat healthfully. There's always something good to be found. You have to be a bit selective. And by being selective, the sensible thing is to peruse the entire buffet line first, or know what's ahead, and then you can pick from there. You don't have to have something of everything. Whatever veggie is going, though, try to go half your plate with some kind of veggie or salad. And then when it comes to protein, roughly a quarter of the plate is a safe bet. Chicken, fish, beef, whatever's on the menu. Saving some room on your plate for it might be a bun, or it might be a piece of corn if you're at a barbecue. Mashed potatoes, potato salad. These things fit on a quarter of your plate. You still have a little room left over for dessert. And if you're eating slowly, then that will be a filling and satisfying meal, and you're really still participating in everything, and you can go to all occasions.
And that's the thing about this book. You don't prevent us from eating anything. Like, you don't say don't eat pork or don't eat whatever, sugar or something like that, right?
Exactly. Many of our recipes actually call for sugar.
Yeah.
Baked goods have sugar in, because sugar's not the enemy per se. It's all about the quantity. Sugar-sweetened beverages, pop, and juice is really quite ridiculous. But, you know, some sugar added to foods in reasonable portions is perfectly fine, and it helps people fit in and not have to do something out of the ordinary.
And diet sodas, because they have whatever they have in them, other than sugar, say additives like aspartame or so on, are those good in lieu of, say, the regular Coke or the whatever regular soft drink one usually drinks?
The when it came to writing about diet sodas, I had to really think. I would have to say, and I did say in the book, that on balance, these diet drinks do seem okay. However, there is a downside to everything. Maybe the best beverage is taking one's own club soda and giving a squirt of juice to that. Or, you know, we take also water, add some fruit, cubes of fruit, and let that sit overnight. Watermelon, cucumber is really nice. And drinking that, that might be the best. But if it comes to convenience and variety, there are loads of carbonated beverages that are only 0 grams of carbohydrate. And, you know, I hate to have people miss out on this big variety of things to drink, but, you know, there is some negative research against Diet Pop.
I see. Yeah. Barbara, you've given us a lot of good information today. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
And I do recommend that people pick up the book. There's a lot of lot more and good information as well as these recipes. So I suggest people pick up the book. It's called The Diabetes Prevention and Management Cookbook, Your 10-Step Plan for Nutrition and Lifestyle. Robert Rose and the Canadian Diabetes Association publishes it. Its authors, Joanna Burkhardt and Barbara Allen. Barbara Allen joined me on the line from Richmond, British Columbia in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.